You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9am to 12 midday.
You're very welcome back to the programme. Morning Focus here on Clare FM. We're with you until 12 noon. Now, I want to meet a gentleman who's got some links with us here in County Clare, who's recently been honoured with a very prestigious award to mark his lifetime achievement in pro bono, a free legal work on cross-channel. His name is Patrick O'Connor. He's QC and barrister with Doughty Street Chambers. They're based in London. And as I say, Patrick, good morning to you. A few links to County Clare as well.
Good morning, Gavin, and to all your listeners, a pleasure to speak to you.
And to you, sir. Thanks very much for joining us. So, can we claim you?
Well, yes, a little. I mean, I'm so proud of my Irish roots, and they're very real, and I know a lot about them. But, I'm my mother's German, so I'm half Irish, half German, And so I have this passion in me, and I have this cold German rationality. And so my professional life has been a sort of a battle between the two. And sometimes one wins, sometimes the other wins. But I hope it's a productive one and has enriched my life and helped my clients.
It's your great-grandfather who's from Ennis, you were telling me.
Absolutely, yes. He was James, and he fathered the magnificent Joseph Patrick Sarsfield James Ignatius O'Connor, who's my grandfather. He had a wonderful Irish singing voice. He used to sing the ballads to the ladies on the deck chairs in New Brighton. I've got a photograph of him in his regalia next to me now in my office here. And he sang at the opening of the Liver Buildings in Liverpool.
I see, wow.
And then my father was Dennis Bellew. So that's my Irish ancestry.
Very good, very good indeed. And now you are working, as I've mentioned, as a barrister with Doughty Street Chambers in London. So that makes you, in our mind's eye, one of the chaps with the black gown and the wig on your head arguing in front of a pretty high court, I guess.
That's how it goes, but we do a lot of work out of court as well.
Of course, yeah.
You know, advising and preparing. Sometimes you can work for a month or 6 weeks, 2 months, and then you're in court for a day or two. So, the public profile is all of that. And the QCs, they wear a black silk gown. You call them SCs at the Irish bar.
Yeah.
You work on the more important cases. Yeah.
And it was actually, why I reached out to you, because as I mentioned in my introduction, you recently were conferred with what's called a Sydney Ellen Goldsmith Award for Lifetime Achievement in Pro Bono, which singles you out as one of the good guys, because pro bono means you're helping the little fella get to court when in many people's minds, it's prohibitively expensive to do that. And you've worked on a few cases that will actually be familiar with listeners, and I wanted to explore some of those. And maybe first of all, a case that will be very familiar to a lot of us, the Guildford Four, working with Irish people there. Talk to me about your recollections in that case.
Oh, of course. Well, it's indelibly imprinted on my mind. I mean, I think we must separate out, you know, some of the bigger cases that I've done from the pro bono work, which has also involved some big cases.
But sure.
The Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, which I worked on, and other big appeals, I mean, they were paid. That's work.
As is perfectly entitled, of course.
You know, thank God it had to be. Unforgettably, I represented Jerry Conlon and his father, Giuseppe, who had died in prison. It sounds odd to represent somebody who's dead, but I represented the two of them at the time of the successful appeal. And I can still remember looking out of the window at the Old Bailey and looking down in the street at the famous scenes of them celebrating their release outside court. And I was very happy to meet up with Jerry a year or so before he died, and we spent a very emotional evening out together, having a curry in Belfast. He was a broken man, but so brave. Mm. And he, as you know, he traveled the world speaking and fighting for justice for others. If I could just make the same point about the Birmingham Six, I mean, Paddy Hill fighting injustice now, he told me how his happiest times would be sitting in a tiny council flat with a friend who, from his time of imprisonment. He'd drive up for the weekend, he'd go to this friend's small flat, and they play cards all weekend, and that's where he was sort of happiest and safest. He couldn't cope with the outside world, you know, and the difficulties these victims have to struggle with for the rest of their lives is unimaginable, really.
Because they have been incarcerated for so long, and it's clearly had a kind of a scarring experience by the sounds of it.
Totally. And the lack, although one can hear about these headlines about the compensation amount of money that they get, that you know, that obviously that matters, but it doesn't, that doesn't cure them or help them. They get these people, these victims of miscarriages of justice, they get released and literally they get chucked out on the street and that's it. There's no facility, no support network given to them by the state who've imposed this injustice on them. And it's still a scar on our system. That's still what happens. Mm. And of course, it's years until they get any financial compensation anyway.
How did you end up as the representative in both of these cases?
It was through the wonderful Gareth Pearce, who's so famous, and she featured in, of course, the film In the Name of the Father, which was made about the Guildford Four case, quite rightly, very prominently. I mean, she's a model solicitor, and I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time for these cases as a generation of lawyers who fought the battles. One little detail people may remember from the film, that the moment they were released, they threw flowers from the dock at the Old Bailey outside in celebration. I was leaving home that morning and there was a vase of flowers and I thought, I know, let's give them a flower each. And it was a nice image and a nice moment, just a symbolic little thing of freedom, you know, for them. But, you know, they suffer, as I'm sure you know, from the books they've written and the interviews they've given, yeah.
Absolutely, indeed. And I mean, when you're in the heart of a case like that, does the outside pressure influence you in any way? I know it shouldn't. And obviously, in terms of the judge, they're judging on what's happening in front of them in the courtroom. But there's intense scrutiny. There is so much at stake.
It gets to you. It shouldn't affect the content of what you do. You have to navigate these pressures. I can remember the moment Jerry Conlon turned to me and to Gareth Pearce and another barrister, and he looked us in the eye, and he had beautiful light blue eyes, and he just said, "I just want you to know my life is in your hands." And we just sat there in silence, and it went straight to our hearts. You got to chill up your spine, you know. And it, of course it was true, but we had to sort of absorb this and then get on with a job, you know, as if it was another, just any other case, you know. Mm. And then I remember the Birmingham Six all praying under the dock before, in fact, what was their unsuccessful appeal, all of them together just saying a prayer before they went up. You know, these are unforgettable moments. I was just privileged to experience them.
And in terms of your memories of the trial, you must have felt like you were taking on a huge system, that it was much more than the evidence at hand. There were strong vested interests, which, again, in a legal sense, shouldn't have an influence, but these things do happen.
Yes, very much. And sadly, my Birmingham Six appeal experience was unsuccessful, and the judges almost relished rejecting the case. It was really the Guildford Four that was the breakthrough, and it was the breakthrough because the prosecution discovered we were onto it. Mm. Gareth Pearce and I were onto, there was something very wrong, and we were onto it, and we were visiting a police station with room full of documents, and we were asking for things which we weren't getting. But little did we know, the prosecution had some killer material which they knew they were going to have to disclose. This is in the Guildford 4 case, and they knew they were going to have to give in the appeal. And so they conceded it, so the judges couldn't reject, they couldn't very well turn that one down.
Of course,
And it's only speculation that if we'd have had to fight that case, if there'd been something not quite so killer, would we have won? I don't know.
Is there a sense of pride in the aftermath of the verdict that you were looking for in a case such as that?
Yes, there is. And we have to, I suppose it's a little bit like, you know, surgeons or whatever. You take in the good times because they have to fuel you through the bad times. The sense of pride and accomplishment has to carry you through those many more times, actually, when you feel frustrated and, frankly, you've lost. You've done your best, but you've lost.
I wanted to talk, and I think this one was a pro bono case. I wanted to talk as well about another case where it's actually had a bigger impact than many of us may realise, where you advocated on behalf of people that you were representing against BP Oil and Shell Oil and others with regards to fumes. And maybe tell us about the background of that case, first of all.
Well, it was specifically about lead in petrol, which is a poison. I mean, nobody feeds anybody lead. They know it's a poison. And younger generations won't really even be aware of this, but there was a time when all petrol had lead in it. And some sort of hippie families and a sort of quite a rich trustafarian, as they're called, started some litigation, and we acted for no fee to take on these giants to stop them adding lead to petrol and poisoning children under Westway in West London, anywhere. And the stance that they took was quite extraordinary and dishonest. I mean, these companies all argued that cars will not work unless there is lead in petrol. Basically, the whole of our transport system, all our roads, all motor vehicles, all internal combustion engines will just seize up and die unless there's lead in petrol. That was actually their argument. Anyway, we won at two levels, and then the Court of Appeal did dismiss our claim. But, and this is a big but, it's a very good example of losing a case but winning the argument. I think the petrol companies knew that the writing was on the wall. And a few years later, they started trying to sell lead-free petrol, which is, of course, what we've got now.
Of course,
and
yeah,
they're obviously, cars didn't seize up. They worked perfectly well. Trouble is, they couldn't sell it. Nobody would buy lead-free petrol because they bought their lies. So they actually approached the campaign against lead in petrol to help them sell lead-free petrol.
So, wow.
And the alliance was formed, and eventually lead was abolished from petrol. And, you know, our atmosphere is that much better.
You've cleaned up the world a little bit.
Well, it's one. I mean, obviously, we have other pollutants now, very strong ones. But that was the most dreadful period for air pollution.
Why do you take on a case such as that? Is it a sense of decency? Is it a sense of trying to do common good? Are you simply trying to help your quote unquote clients?
Well, I feel a general moral duty. I'm in a privileged position. I'm in a position where I do work, I get paid reasonably well. And you have to pay something back. And obviously you can pick and choose your cases. You know, nobody can come to you and say, look, I've got no money, please represent me free. And it seems to me to be hopeless, or I don't fancy it. I can really pick and choose there. And so you choose good causes, and that was a good cause. And then other free cases I've done, death penalty cases, obviously you can't get people in a more desperate situation
than them
in death row in the Caribbean. And so I've done a number of those cases. And then we would come to inquests. I can just explain the situation there a little bit. It may well be the same in Ireland.
Yeah,
bereaved families where somebody has died in prison or in police custody, get no legal aid, or very rarely get any legal aid in our system, and they get very little information. And of course, all the authorities, the hospitals or the prisons or the police, turn up with teams and teams of lawyers and thousands of pages of documents. And there's the family, you know, faced with expert evidence which they can't challenge, and they have to have a voice. It's part of the grieving process that they understand what's happened to their loved one, and I feel it's very, very important that representation is given to them. And sometimes I've done a few which have lasted 6 weeks.
A very long time for an inquest, yeah.
Yep. And have resulted in unlawful killing verdicts, and have led, for instance, to a review of the use of CS spray by the police, because that was part of the causation of a death. Okay. In one of the cases I did, yeah.
And, I mean, it all speaks of, again, going back to that point I know I made already, but it all speaks of this system that needs to be fought against. You talk of a moral responsibility to act, and you've been recognised for that, and well done to you, because it has led to social change, and it obviously has assisted people to the best of your abilities. But the fact that you have to do it in the first place smacks possibly of an injustice that's existing otherwise.
There is a danger of pro bono work being regarded as a sticking plaster on a system which is wholly skewed and unfair. And our Bar Council is very aware of that and presents a very good and balanced picture to the public and to government, saying, here we are doing this pro bono work, this is our moral duty, but we are not here to fill in for what the state should be doing and to remedy these gross injustices. That requires, you know, a change in the law or better resourcing, etc. I must say, in all modesty, I mean, I'm just a representative of what is a very broad ethos, I'm absolutely sure, at the Irish Bar as well, where we all feel this duty. I mean, I happen to have got this award, but I think, you know, the overwhelming majority of barristers have done pro bono work and show a similar commitment.
Well, look, congratulations to you for your efforts. It'll continue to date. There are more cases, I'm sure, in the pipeline that you're probably less free to talk about, but there's a lot more to come from Patrick O'Connor.
There certainly is. In fact, I can tell you there's one going back to the Nazi occupation of Guernsey and a dreadful injustice in 1942. So I won't tell you any more of that, but that's one of the more extraordinary cases that I've still got on. Fabulous to talk to you.
I shall keep an eye out for it, and who knows, we may talk about it in more detail when that's possible. Patrick O'Connor, congratulations. And a pleasure to share a little bit of time in your company. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
A great pleasure.